Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The gun control debate is shifting today, with President Trump now appearing to be retreating from the comments that he made Wednesday. That was when the president seemed open to proposals such as restricting gun sales to those under 21, seizing guns from those with mental illness, and implementing stronger background checks.
They have to be strong. The background checks, hey, look, I'm the biggest fan of the Second Amendment. Many of you are. I'm a big fan of the NRA, but I had lunch with them, with Wayne and Chris and David, on Sunday, and said, it's time. We got to stop this nonsense. It's time.
But then, on Twitter last night, a top NRA lobbyist said the president was backing away from stricter gun control measures. And today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters that Trump promised the NRA that he would, quote, continue to support the Second Amendment. Well, gun control is the first topic we're taking up with our Week in Review panelists today. With me in studio this week, Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Deb.
Also with us is Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Hi there, Ed.
Hi, good to be back.
So let's talk about, where we're seeing this conversation on gun control shift and what it means. Renee.
You know, I think the important thing is when the president had that bipartisan meeting, it felt to me almost like a kind of flashback to him sitting in the boardroom at The Apprentice. It felt like a performance. Mm. So anybody who heard that and thought, oh my God, he's really shifting his stance on gun control, was really missing the point. What the president says and what he eventually does are two vastly different things. And I think people should have figured that out by now.
Mm. So when you heard those promises Wednesday, you were like, this is meaningless.
I did. I was never convinced.
You didn't think?
You know, there's so many things that could have been done. We're already 2 weeks past the Parkland shooting, and nothing's been done. He kept talking about bump stocks. Has he done anything about bump stocks? So, you know, all these ideas about, well, you know, we can confiscate the guns and we need gun control. It was all for show. The cameras were there, and it was a performance.
Ed, your thoughts?
I think guns are a very serious problem. I think, like opiates, that it will require years of advocacy and policy solutions. I don't think it's really about what anyone says at a given moment. I think that we will need to see Congress do a lot of things. I think that's much more important than what the President of the United States is saying and doing. I don't think the Congress has had a change of heart about this issue, and if the congressional Republicans don't want to do anything in response to these problems, I don't think it matters what the president says.
Hmm. So, go ahead.
I do think the president can set the tone, and I think the president can express a serious intent to do something about guns in this country. I don't think he's going to do that. So, you know, there's no one pushing Congress to do anything differently.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we understand that. But so what's happening is that folks and corporations seem to be taking this debate into their own hands to a certain degree, either people pressuring companies or companies themselves. We've heard a lot about that this week as well. We heard the CEO of Dick's Sporting Goods. We heard him on Good Morning America this week, Ed Stack. He said they're going to end sales of assault rifles. Let's listen.
Based on what's happened and looking at those kids and those parents, it moved us all unimaginably, and to think about the loss and the grief that those kids and those parents had, we said we need to do something, and we're taking these guns out of all of our stores.
And so Dick's was just one company. We also heard from Kroger Company, the largest supermarket chain in the U.S., tightening gun selling policies. We also heard about L.L. Bean no longer selling guns to those under 21 at its Freeport, Maine location. So companies are responding, and folks are threatening boycotts to those companies that don't take certain steps. I'm wondering, does this make it difficult for these companies, for politicians? What are your thoughts about this, Renee?
You know, do I think it makes it difficult for politicians? I think only in as much as people keep that story on the front page and keep it on the front burner. It has been gratifying to see a reaction. You know, usually, you know, grief is very paralyzing, but this time there's also been a sense of anger and the need for action. And we haven't really seen that in a lot of these other shootings. You know, we had the Las Vegas shooting last fall, and that faded remarkably, you know, quickly, given the fact that 58 people were murdered. You know, it wasn't a lot going on. So I think I'm wary of calling this a tipping point, but I do think there's something to be said for this moment and the fact that people believe that they can do more than that has been done.
Right. So Ed, and, you know, you both had said, well, you know, the president made a statement. Maybe we shouldn't be holding that up as being, you know, this is exactly what's going to happen in Washington regarding gun control. So is it different right now because of the emotion, because of the deep grief, because of seeing teenagers who are taking matters into their own hands? And some folks find that inspiring. Does that change things?
No.
It doesn't.
You know, what's going to change this? Yes, there'll have to be cultural changes around guns. I think, you know, we have to figure out how to get back to the American gun culture of previous decades. I don't think we should compare ourselves to Iceland and Japan. We should say, how can we get back to the gun culture under Ronald Reagan? I think that people in the 1980s who owned guns wouldn't recognize the NRA today. They wouldn't recognize the kinds of weapons we're buying. They wouldn't recognize our discussion around guns. I think that there is a lot that's wrong. But a lot of what we have to do is legislatively, and I don't see anything that's going to change in Washington. I mean, the House Republicans literally got shot by somebody, and they didn't change their minds.
And he supports
Congressman Scalia. You know, Scalise, actually, he nearly died, multiple transfusions.
Right.
He got out, and he wants to make it easier to buy guns.
Right.
Do we really think that NRA contributions gave someone that kind of deathbed conviction about how to handle guns? I don't think there's any point talking to people like him about changing the gun laws. It's not about saving kids' lives. They won't save their own lives.
So do corporations have a responsibility to step up? Do they need to?
Sure. I mean, I think it's great that they're taking this on, but because of our attention deficit media, they could change their minds and start selling these things again a year from now. We'd never hear about it. I think it's great that they're involved. I don't think that's nearly adequate. I can't imagine going back to Sandy Hook and saying, you know, several years from now, we're going to have this big moment where we take away the rental car discounts of the National Rifle Association. They would say to me, you mean you're still failing? So I really don't think we're making progress, and I don't think that either side of this debate that's not working has a really good plan on how to move forward.
You know, as with all progress in this country, it's incremental. And on one hand, it says, well, you know, so NRA members can't get a discount from Hertz. Who cares? But it is something. It is movement. And I do think, look, we didn't even know that these discounts existed, you know, a few weeks ago. So I do think that there is a purpose that social media plays in this, in being really diligent and making these companies accountable and saying, look, we know what you're doing and we have a problem with that and you need to stop.
Unless you're Delta, right? And now, of course, you lose a tax break because of taking this stand. The governor of Georgia today signed into law, you know, a bill that takes away that tax break for Delta.
But let's see if there are repercussions for Georgia for doing that, the same way that certain states were being punished when they were going against the transgender community. And, you know, and this company said, well, we're not going to have our convention there, and we're not going to have the All-Star game here and all these different things. You know, there's a lot to be said for what the people can do, and I think we're seeing that right now.
I want to get back to those some of these young voices, because we've been hearing a lot about them, and people are saying that this changes the debate. And locally, there are some young folks who are also taking matters into their own hands. There was a walkout this week in Somerville to push for stronger gun control, and we spoke with some of the students who walked out in Somerville, and this is a little bit of tape from 16-year-old student Amalia Hockman.
We want to show that we're willing to risk our academics because we want to feel safe for ourselves, and we want to make sure that our students and peers cross country are safe.
So that's one student. You know we have more. We have a national walkout planned on March 14th. We've got protests on the Common at the end of the month. And I know, Ed, you say this doesn't change much, but Renee, do you think it does?
I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's always this sense that, well, nobody's paying attention or who cares. But, you know, there were a lot of young people during the civil rights era who put their lives on the line and who were out there and risked getting beaten and getting arrested and losing, you know, being pushed out of their schools because the cause was that important. I think we're seeing that again. You know, there's no abstract with these kids. You know, they survived. They did something that a lot of us will never go through. They ran for their lives and they saw their friends die. And so they're very motivated to see change. And I don't think that they're going to wear down. And we're not just talking about the kids in Parkland. We're talking about millions of school children.
Mm. Do you think we'll see states take action on their own, though?
I mean, I think we already have. I mean, you know, when everyone was waiting for Congress to do something about bump stocks, Massachusetts became the first state to ban them. So I think it's going to become something that starts evolving state by state.
Okay, let's move on to another topic here. Massachusetts State Police. More turmoil in the state police this week. This is prompted by a Boston Globe report yesterday that a trooper apparently has a long history of making vulgar and racist comments online. And the Globe identified this trooper as being Trooper Matthew Sheehan, a trooper who was already on leave while officials looked into his shooting of a man during a police chase last weekend. And Governor Charlie Baker responded to the Boston Globe report yesterday. Let's listen.
If those posts were issued by someone who's a member of the state police, they are clearly a violation of the code of conduct, and he or she should be fired.
Renee, your reaction to this latest controversy in the Massachusetts State Police?
You know, speaking about what's happened with this Officer Sheehan, my first question is, did people at the state police know about these posts prior to the shooting he's now being investigated over? So if they did, then that speaks to, again, another problem going on in the state police. In what way is this tolerated? How was this officer on the street given the attitudes he has about people of color? So it has to come to the fact that he's actually shot someone for some action to be taken and for people now be outraged. I just wonder what's going on there right now. I mean, this is certainly the last thing the state police needed, but maybe it's the thing that finally pushes them to get their house in order.
Ed, hear reaction.
Well, I agree. I think that, we don't often have clarity into how police departments operate. They're often very opaque to us. They have very strong unions. They tend to look after themselves and not talk about what the problems they have with other officers. So whenever something like this happens, we have no idea how serious the problem even is. Hearing that there's this sort of private group where they can talk to each other and say these things, you know, we had no knowledge that a group even existed. So I want to say, like, are you creating environments that enable this to get better, or are you putting things in place to kind of educate these people into not thinking this way, or to move them out if they can't change?
Let's put it in context for those folks who may not know some of the background. I'll try to be as brief and simple as possible here. We've had four high-ranking state police officials retire since November amid some other controversies. First, a lawsuit from a trooper alleging that he was forced to change an arrest report for a judge's daughter, Trooper Ryan Sevier. He filed a lawsuit, and actually when he did file, we spoke with his attorney, who's Leonard Keston. And Attorney Keston said that the suit alleges that top state police brass play favorites, and then they punished Trooper Sevier for not going along. Let's listen.
He simply reported what he heard, and now he gets sanctioned because he treated her as he would anybody else, and apparently the colonel wants connected people treated differently.
Okay, the colonel did step down after that. But then recently, another controversy was when a trooper was suspended after it was determined that she had been a co-conspirator in a marijuana trafficking case. So these are significant issues within the state police. What message does that suggest to you, Renee? I mean, what do you take from that?
You know, you get the sense there must be some kind of like institutional rot at this point. You know, there's no accountability, there's a lack of transparency, and again, you know, it's the sense that they're just doing whatever they want and that they're not accountable to anyone.
Okay. I wonder, also, the salaries of these troopers are generating a lot of comments. The woman trooper who admitted to money laundering and marijuana dealing, she was with the state police for 4 years, and she was earning more than $150,000 a year. Trooper Sheehan, who was the person who was making the posts online, earned more than $230,000 in 2016. What about these salaries, Ed? I mean, what do you make of those, and what does that say about state police? I know you've talked about the lack of transparency, but do you think that folks will also be looking at salaries in all of these?
Sure. I mean, when public sector salaries are high, it's usually because they have a strong union and a lot of political power. I think that police are very well paid. And when you hear about some of these scandals, it sounds like, wow, they thought they could get away with anything. I can't imagine that you'd be pressure somebody into doing a political favor for someone else and to be so open about it. I find that shocking. I can't imagine that happening any place that I've worked in my life. So you think to yourself, wow, these people thought that they were sort of in an organization where they could do whatever they wanted, and they were being paid an enormous amount of money to behave in this way. That must create a real feeling of self-importance and authority.
It's like, what could possibly go wrong with that scenario, right?
How much of a political liability is this for Charlie Baker? Big one, do you think? Continuing one? Could the state public safety secretary step down, Renee?
It depends. You know, let's, you know, if there's another incident, you know, it also depends on how these current investigations are concluded. You know, it could be a problem for him. I don't think it is yet. And you know, as usual, right now he's saying the right thing. If this trooper did this, he needs to be fired. But, you know, it's something he's going to need to be mindful of.
Ed, your thoughts?
Well, we don't know. I mean, my guess is that these kinds of failures represent something that's been a problem for a very long time. I don't think that this happened when Shelly Baker became governor. I get the feeling that it's going to say, well, for many years, things were run in this way. So if that's the case, I don't think it'll affect him at all. I think you'd have to show that something developed recently or that there were warning signs that his administration was aware of and didn't act upon. But barring those things, I don't think so.
Hmm. Well, let's move on quickly here to the big news this week from Amazon. Amazon says it's going to bring at least 2,000 new jobs to Boston. It's leasing an 18-story building in the Seaport District with the potential to expand into a nearby building in the Seaport District with another 2,000 workers. Now, this, of course, everyone has questions about what this means for Amazon's possible location of its second headquarters. Amazon says that this expansion in the Seaport District is not related to the search for its second headquarters, or HQ2, as we all now seem to call it. Now, that project would employ some 50,000 people, and we know that Boston is one of the 20 finalist cities for HQ2. And Mayor Marty Walsh was asked, so does this new expansion in the Seaport mean that Boston is out of the running for the headquarters? Let's listen.
HQ2 is a completely different arm of the company. And when you think about it, it's, you know, they're looking to do more with what's in Seattle as far as the company and the services in the company. So
I wonder, Renee, Amazon is saying that, you know, it wants to bring these employees to the Seaport. Should we be celebrating here, or should we be saying Boston lost the headquarters?
You know, my first thought was, you know, is Boston getting hors d'oeuvres and not the main course? you know, I'm wondering if it's a consolation prize. It's a very good consolation prize, but it's not what the city's really aiming for. So the timing seems a little strange to people. Mm. You know, and it was interesting as this news was breaking, the real estate website Zillow came out with a survey that essentially said Boston's out of the running. And one of the reasons it's out of the running is because it's very expensive to live here, and that other areas like the D.C. metro area and Atlanta might be more favorable to Amazon. So having that, you know, sort of float up at the same time that they announced this, it's a little strange.
Ed, your thoughts?
Well, it feels like it's less likely because one of the reasons why they wanted to build another headquarters is because they had too many eggs in one basket on the West Coast. So I feel like that the more eggs they dump in this basket here, it would seem to violate that. I mean, they already had an office here. They now own the Whole Foods all over the place. Now they're going to add 2,000 people to the Seaport. So it would seem that way. I guess it depends on what their interest is in us. If it's just, you know, a city that has, an airport nearby and all of that, maybe they don't. But if they want us for our ethics and our culture and things that are unique to Boston, maybe they still will come here. But I think at this point, to add even more people to Boston, they have to want what's unique about Boston. They have to come here to say, we need some of Boston's values in order to improve our image. I think if that's not the reason they're coming here, then it would seem to me that this latest move makes that less likely.
That's a lovely parting gift.
That's all. It's the hors d'oeuvre. We're not getting the meal. I hope you're not hungry. But if we look at just what we know about this move to the Seaport at this point, this deal, apparently, according to the reports about it, was that Amazon would get $5 million in city tax breaks in exchange for 2,000 jobs created within 25 miles of Boston by 2025. And those tax breaks would double if Amazon creates another 2,000 jobs in that second building, right, in the Seaport District. So $10 million possible total tax breaks for 4,000 jobs. Now, many of us remember, because it wasn't all that long ago, that General Electric in the Seaport got almost $25 million in city tax breaks. It got a total of $145 million in city and state, but $25 million in city tax breaks for 800 jobs. $25 million, 800... $10 million, 4,000. I mean, it just seems like a very different scenario here. Can we compare them like that or not, Ed?
No.
I knew you'd say that.
Well, I don't mean if it has to be yes or no, I'd say no. I think that these deals are often very different. It depends on what kinds of jobs. It depends on what the site looked like before they developed it. The theory of Boston changes over time. I think that as Boston changes and its needs change, that we make different kinds of deals. So I think that even the time passing between the GE deal and the Amazon deal really matters, because the parts of Boston you're looking at have really changed. I mean, the Seaport, you know, a year is like a decade in every other part of the city. So, I mean, imagine that the nerds at the Boston plans had decided that, you know, the Seaport is different than it was for GE. And actually it is. GE actually is part of what made it different.
Hmm. Are there lessons, though, to be taken from the GE experience?
You know, there should be. You know, the interesting thing about the Amazon deal that we learned about this week is, you know, the people who fume about these things and get upset, this isn't going to make them feel any better. You know, are they comparable? No. But people are going to think they're comparable. So, you know, there is going to be this sense of people sort of scratching their heads and just wondering, is the city being really smart about this? You know, and are they looking out for the people who are here as much as they are the people who might start coming into the city?
Do you think we'll see? Neither of you seem to think we're going to see an Amazon headquarters located in Boston.
I think we might. I think there's a good chance. I just think it's probably a little bit less likely because of this, but I still think that it's possible.
Anything's possible. I don't think it's going to happen, though.
Okay. Well, we have time to end with our hubbubs. Those are the brief stories or events that maybe didn't make it into the headlines this week but would have caught our attention. Renee, do you have a hubbub this week?
Yeah. Just want to give a quick shout-out to community activists Bridget Wallace and Carol Now, who are the founders of the startup incubator Skylab, who are transforming an old Victorian in Roxbury into a living space for young women of color pursuing careers in science, tech, engineering, and math.
Mm. All right.
So it sounds like a great thing.
Yeah. Ed, do you have a hubbub?
That was wonderful, by the way, Renee. I'm glad I learned about that.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to call attention to the Seaport gondola, a private plan to bring a gondola into the Seaport. I think, by the way, if it were there today, you could go above the floodwaters and get into the Seaport. I think it is a wonderful climate mitigation strategy to put a gondola in the Seaport. All of my transportation nerd friends don't like to seat the gondola because they think it's a distraction from sensible things like BRT and all of that. I'm for all that, too. But this is all privately funded, and I think it would be a wonderful thing for Boston. I brought it up today just because I think that now it's a serious project. In a way that before it was more speculative, but now I think that there's a good chance that they're really going to do it, and if they do it, I'm going to buy a ticket.
All right, gondola. Maybe Amazon and all of that would help. Well, I have a little one. Reddit. I don't know if you saw this, but Reddit posted a tweet from someone who had said, quote, "Even though the MBTA is still broken and terrible, their new Twitter alerts do an amazing job of informing me specifically of what crappy broken thing I should be mad about at what exact time." So while that's a pretty entertaining tweet, the MBTA responded. How did the MBTA respond? With a like to the tweet. All right, we just want to end with that. Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and WBUR contributor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer, thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.